harshly at times that they speak only Italian. Luigi spoke slowly, clearly, and repeated everything 4 times until Marco figured it out. Then he moved along to the next phrase. It was impossible to enjoy food under such pressure. At midnight, Marco was in his bed in his cold room, wrapped tightly with the thin blanket, sipping orange juice he had ordered himself, and memorizing list after list of verbs and adjectives. What could Robert Kritz have possibly done to get himself killed by people who might also be looking for Joel Backman? The question itself was too bizarre to ask. He couldn't begin to contemplate an answer. He assumed Kritz was present when the pardon was granted. Ex-President Morgan was incapable of making such a decision by himself. Beyond that, though, it was impossible to see Kritz involved at a higher level. He had proven for decades that he was nothing more than a good hatchet man. Very few people trusted him. But if people were still dying, then it was urgent that he learn the verbs and adjectives scattered on his bed. Language meant survival and movement. Luigi and Hermano would soon disappear, and Marco Lazzari would be left to fend for himself. Chapter 12. Marco escaped his claustrophobic room, or apartment as it was called, and went for a long walk at daybreak. The sidewalks were almost as damp as the frigid air. With a pocket map Luigi had given him, all in Italian, of course, he made his way into the old city, and once past the ruins of the ancient walls at Porta San Donato, he headed west on Via Irnerio, along the north edge of the university section of Bologna. The sidewalks were centuries old and covered with what appeared to be miles of arching porticos. Evidently, street life began late in the university section. An occasional car passed, then a bike or two, but the foot traffic was still asleep. Luigi had explained that Bologna had a history of left-wing communist leanings. It was a rich history, one that Luigi promised to explore with him. Ahead, Marco saw a small green neon sign that was indifferently advertising the Bar Fontana, and as he walked toward it, he soon picked up the scent of strong coffee. The bar was wedged tightly into the corner of an ancient building, but then they were all ancient. The door opened reluctantly, and once inside, Marco almost smiled at the aromas, coffee, cigarettes, pastries, breakfast on a grill in the rear. Then the fear hit, the usual apprehension of trying to order in an unknown language. Bar Fontana was not for students or for women. The crowd was his age, 50 and up, somewhat oddly dressed, with enough pipes and beards to identify it as a hangout for faculty. One or two glanced his way, but in the center of a university with 100,000 students, it was difficult for anyone to draw attention. Marco got the last small table near the back, and when he finally nestled into his spot with his back to the wall, he was practically shoulder to shoulder with his new neighbors, both of whom were lost in their morning papers, and neither of whom appeared to notice him. In one of Luigi's lectures on Italian culture, he had explained the concept of space in Europe and how it differed significantly from that in the States. Space is shared in Europe, not protected. Tables are shared. The air evidently is shared because smoking bothered no one. Cars, houses, buses, apartments, cafes, so many important aspects of life are smaller, thus more cramped, thus more willingly shared. It's not offensive to go nose to nose with an acquaintance during routine conversation because no space is being violated. Talk with your hands, hug, embrace, even kiss at times. Even for a friendly people, such familiarity was difficult for Americans to understand. And Marco was not yet prepared to yield too much space. He picked up the wrinkled menu on the table and quickly settled on the first thing he recognized. Just as the waiter stopped and glanced down at him, he said, with all the ease he could possibly exude, "Espresso e un panino al formaggio," a small cheese sandwich. The waiter nodded his approval. Not a single person glanced over to check out his accented Italian. No newspapers dipped to see who he might be. No one cared. They heard accents all the time. As he placed the menu back on the table, Marco Lazzari decided that he probably liked Bologna, even if it turned out to be a nest for communists. With so many students and faculty coming and going, and from all over the world, foreigners were accepted as part of the culture. Perhaps it was rather cool to have an accent and dress differently. Perhaps it was okay to openly study the language. One sign of a foreigner was that he noticed everything, his eyes darting around as if he knew he was trespassing into a new culture and didn't want to get caught. Marco would not be caught taking in the sights in the Bar Fontana. He removed a booklet of vocabulary sheets and tried mightily to ignore the people and scenes he wanted to watch. Verbs, verbs, verbs. Ermanno kept saying that to master Italian, or any Romance language for that matter, you had to know the verbs. The booklet had 1,000 of the basic verbs, and Ermanno claimed that it was a good starting point. As tedious as rote memorization was, Marco was finding an odd pleasure in it. He found it quite satisfying to zip through 4 pages, 100 verbs or nouns or anything for that matter, and not miss a one. When he got one wrong or missed a pronunciation, he went back to the beginning and punished himself by starting over. He had conquered 300 verbs when his coffee and sandwich arrived. He took a sip, went back to work as if the food was much less important than the vocab, and was somewhere over 400 when Rudolph arrived. The chair on the other side of Marco's small round table was vacant, and this caught the attention of a short, fat man dressed entirely in faded black, with wild bunches of gray, frizzy hair protruding from all parts of his head, some of it barely suppressed by a black beret that somehow managed to stay aboard.
"Buongiorno, è libera?"
he asked politely, gesturing toward the chair. Marco wasn't sure what he said, but it was obvious what he wanted. Then he caught the word libera and assumed it meant free or vacant. "Si," Marco managed with no accent, and the man removed a long black cape, draped it over the chair, then maneuvered himself into position. When he came to rest, they were less than 3 feet apart. "Space is different here," Marco kept telling himself. The man placed a copy of L'Unità on the table, making it rock back and forth. For an instant, Marco was worried about his espresso. To avoid conversation, he buried himself even deeper into Ermanno's verbs. "American?" his new friend said in English with no foreign accent. Marco lowered the booklet and looked into the glowing eyes not far away. "Close. Canadian."
"How'd you know?"
He nodded at the booklet and said, "English to Italian vocabulary. You don't look British, so I figure you're American." Judging by his accent, he was probably not from the upper Midwest, not from New York or New Jersey, not from Texas or the South or Appalachia or New Orleans. As vast sections of the country were eliminated, Marco was beginning to think of California, and he was beginning to get very nervous. The lying would soon start, and he hadn't practiced enough. "And where are you from?" he asked.
"Last stop was Austin, Texas. That was 30 years ago. Name's Rudolph."
"Good morning, Rudolph. A pleasure. I'm Marco." They were in kindergarten, where only first names were needed.
"You don't sound Texan." "Thank God for that," he said with a pleasant laugh, one that barely revealed his mouth. "Originally from San Francisco."
The waiter leaned in and Rudolph ordered black coffee, then something else in rapid Italian. The waiter had a follow-up, as did Rudolph, and Marco understood none of it.
"What brings you to Bologna?" Rudolph asked.
He seemed anxious to chat, probably rare that he cornered a fellow North American in his favorite café. Marco lowered his booklet and said, "Just traveling around Italy for a year, seeing the sights, trying to pick up some of the language." Half of Rudolph's face was covered with an unkempt gray beard that began fairly high up the cheekbones and sprang in all directions. Most of his nose was visible, as was part of his mouth. For some odd reason, one that no one would ever understand because no one would ever dare ask such a ridiculous question, he had developed the habit of shaving a small round spot under his lower lip and comprising most of his upper